You're in the Green Room at the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Green Room's a place we get together with some of our guests and go long, get a little more in-depth on some of the subjects we've been talking about on the Texas Standard. Today, we're going to dig deep on a subject that's not only at the center of some of the most important conflicts facing the world today, but it also hits home for a surprisingly large and growing number of Texans. Take you back a ways. Back in the mid-60s, Lyndon Baines Johnson, when he was president, signed into law a major change in the immigration rules, eliminating per-country quotas and opening up doors on the basis of professional experience and education. Well, from that moment forward, Pakistanis began coming to the U.S. in waves. After New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, Dallas and Houston are top destinations for Pakistani immigrants, accounting for nearly 4% of the populations of both cities, including high numbers of professionals, doctors, engineers, IT experts. All these opportunities, of course, denied many who still live in Pakistan today. That's not so much because it's a failed nation, but because it's a warrior state. At least that's the argument that's being put forth by Dr. T.V. Paul. He is a professor at Montreal's McGill University, and he is also author of the new book, The Warrior State, Pakistan in the Contemporary World. As I see it, you're suggesting that there's a better model for understanding Pakistan. What do you mean by warrior state?
Warrior state is a state that gives enormous importance to national security, that is a very traditional national security, founded on military as its core element. So it pays attention to that, but it ignores other elements of national well-being, such as trade, such as welfare. And as a result, it can devote enormous energy to this enterprise called national security. And sometimes it does not become secure or prosperous, but it persists in that particular mode because of societal reasons, because of outside pressures, a number of pathologies that develop.
I think you would, if you talk to a Pakistani general, for example, many would say, you know, you can't have the luxuries of living in a developed country if you are constantly under this existential threat, which is the way a lot of Pakistanis imagine.
Yes, indeed.
Their world.
That is the challenge. And is it an existential threat? We start looking at it. The Pakistani generals make that argument often. But the existential threat is not quite clear after, especially after 1971. India, as far as I know, has no design on Pakistan occupying or destroying it.
Now, just to be clear, 1971 was the Bangladesh War.
Right. And so this is a big argument. In a way, it's a foil and a facade to continue a particular set of policies that has made the security relationship with India also decline over a period of time. And so if you move away from this framework, start developing trade relations with India, and India is open to that, and start having other non-coercive ways of achieving a territorial resolution to territorial disputes, Pakistan can do a lot more to secure itself than the current approach. I'm not denying Pakistan has no insecurities or Indian policies are always great, but its time has come for them to look forward to a new strategy, because the current strategy and the previous strategies are not working. It's based on coercion, it's based on threats, based on use of non-state actors, and also taking the initiative whenever India was felt to be vulnerable, and which is not very good, because that made India more strident. They are unwilling to compromise on anything. So how long you can continue this pattern, and the region and its people are suffering.
Having said that, what incentive is there for the political and military elites of Pakistan to step back and say, oh, no, we don't need your international aid. We want to develop a new long-term developmental strategy. There really is no incentive given the history of Pakistan, at least up to now.
From a very narrow viewpoint, that is true. But you look at the other countries that changed, most recently Burma or Myanmar. The military is taking a back seat. The military had the same approach toward its own corporatist interests. But today, the Burmese military is showing great ability to adjust. You go to Chile, you go to Indonesia, you go to any number of Latin American countries where the military also had no incentives. If the military is there to support the Pakistani people, their growth, then it has a genuine interest in transforming its own policies. It doesn't have to be based on pure corporate interests. but the interest of its own people. And the military has been using this slogan that we are the protectors. But sometimes the problem with protectors is the protectors can be the challenge. They create policies that generate insecurity, and then they are called back to protect again. This is a vicious circle, and we have seen that in many other parts of the world. And countries do change. It's a mistake to assume that countries can't change. It's the leadership, it's the strategy, it's the willingness to give away some of the privileges you own, through hard work and a willingness to adapt.
Can they do it on their own without, say, for instance, a robust middle class, for example? I mean, will it require other regional players? And if so, given the geostrategic curse that you talk about in your book, who can trust some of these actors to act in the best interests of Pakistan and not their own geostrategic objectives?
Well, what is interesting is places where major reforms took place, let's say Soviet Union under Mikhail Gorbachev, it is a small group of people very passionate about it for change. Same with happened in Brazil, other places. Now, that is the top-down model Pakistan can definitely have if they have a very passionately oriented, development-oriented elite group wanting to change. They can initiate the change. Yes, they have a very small middle class. It's divided on ethnic lines, religious lines. And since the educational system has been rather polluted since Ziaul-Huq's time in the 1980s, the people are kind of disoriented what exactly their goals are, who the threats are, and the kind of conspiracy theories going on. But despite all that, there is a civil society there. The media shows that quite powerfully, that people can be very daring. And only recently, the many media journalists are being attacked. One prominent television newscaster was shot down just last week. And these things are happening because either the military or its intelligence wing is complicit in it, or somebody is doing it and the state is not trying to stop it. The state has to act as the protector of freedom of expression. State has to take on certain tasks that it is assigned as a democracy that it claims to be today. But I think the military and the civilians have to come to terms with the military agreeing to the command or control of the civilians over them, which is not that easy, but it is feasible, and it happened in many other contexts.
It happened with Benazir Bhutto, for example. But there was always a fear that the military would overthrow her or that factions would. I mean, there's always this sense that in the background, there's this looming military presence, the elites,
yes,
who can overrun whatever political institutions might be set up or nascent political institutions might be set up. How do you make that that transition? How do you make that leap?
Well, Turkey, had the same problem. And Erdogan and his party, AKP, has managed to at least restrain the military. Doesn't mean that Turkey is going into the right way. Indonesia had the same problem. It took some gutsy leaders. Benazir, unfortunately, did not do the proper things as you are just arguing. Part of it was she was trying to prove to the military that she is actually tougher than the military. She was the one who, when the Taliban was fighting, she was the one who supported Taliban. She was the one who, AQ Khan's movement was, network was sending nuclear materials to North Korea. She was involved in that process, as far as we know. And so, and religious policies, the Sunni Shia, she was Shia, but she acted like a Sunni. And so there are things that she could have done. Of course, twice she was kind of overthrown. This fear is always there for civilian leaders, but somebody has to do this business of changing. And the civilian leader may be the current one. I don't know. Nawaz Sharif, at least showing some gutsy moves. But that is already generating quite a bit of tension. But one thing they have done, that is the trial of Musharraf, shows that a military leader can be put into trial. But now that may lead to a big estrangement. If they handle it properly, if he is punished, at the same time probably not executed, which is a very dangerous thing for them to do. But obviously, maybe there will be a deal by which he will be going into exile in Saudi Arabia or something. But if the the trial goes on and it proves that the military leader was not behaving properly, it may set a nice pattern of civilian control or judicial control. I can't predict where it is heading, but it is an interesting step.
So let's talk more specifically about where this might take root. I'm thinking back to the presidency of Pervez Musharraf.
Yes.
And thinking about how lawyers got together under his rule and protested, calling for regime change. Is there that kind of activity in civil society today, mm-hmm. where you can see professionals, you can see other sectors of private life in Pakistan start to take hold and demand reform from the elites and from mm-hmm. the generals?
Well, that was an interesting episode. The lawyers fought very vigorously, partly because the Chief Justice was under assault by the Musharraf regime to protect him as well, and took on the military and won. So that shows that you can win.
But it didn't.
Stay. That is the biggest challenge. The civil society is not dynamic enough to persist. The same lawyers were also garlanding the killer of the Punjab governor, who was trying to commute the death sentence of a Christian girl who was sentenced for some alleged blasphemy of the violating the blasphemy law. So that is the kind of civil society we have. But today, the greatest hope is, I think, the media. You read the Pakistani media, you see the enormous amount of critical analysis they are putting out. Of course, I read the English media. I don't know what's going on in the Urdu media. Obviously, that's the most read media. But clearly, there is a civil society emerging. But what is interesting is, though this is so divided, you read the reaction to the TV anchor, the famous TV anchor who was shot this last week. Mm-hmm. And you see the kind of conspiracy theories and the blame game going on that you wonder that, you know, which planet are you in? You know, this man was really critically injured. He would have died. But they're blaming him for his daring reports, at least the majority or a large number of the public who are reacting on the media. So there has to be a change in the mindset of people and a passion for democracy. I think judiciary is the hope there. Media definitely is the hope there. And so if these two work together and political parties change, political parties are still kind of playing both the Islamist and, you know, all sorts of factions mm-hmm. for getting elected. And so if political parties become more development-oriented, economic-oriented, based on economic rationality rather than value rationality, then you can have a transformation. It has a small but growing middle class, and the expatriate community can definitely help. They need to be supportive of change rather than persistence of the old values.
So I want to explore that just a little bit more. As I was mentioning a little earlier, large expatriate populations in Houston, in Dallas, what sort of pressure can they bring to bear, if anything? What voice do these Pakistani Americans have in what's happening in Pakistan now?
I must say that I have now given 35 talks across the United States, and a large number of my audiences have been Pakistanis, especially young Pakistanis. And I was overwhelmed by the sympathetic voice I heard from them after my talk. Many of them linger on, want to talk more about what can we do. But I didn't hear that much from the older generation here. Unfortunately, they seem to have still some of the same ideas about national security threat and how to respond to threat, etc. Now, I won't blame them, because if they suffered a partition or its effect, and the way they were educated with respect to India, with those regions, then it is probably very hard for them to understand or change the way change needs to be done. But I do think that they are sometimes act as supporters of an erstwhile order, which they're longing to bring it back. They have a great responsibility. I think they can bring in a technical expertise. Pakistan needs technical institutions. They haven't put many into place. They need other general education. They need industries. They need companies. They need expertise and talent. All these can come from the United States, as actually the Indian community is doing quite a bit. Silicon Valley especially, they have built these links with Bangalore and other places, Hyderabad and places like that, Chennai and other places. Delhi. And so these pockets can be developed, like the Pakistanis can go back and create a kind of links with these pockets and develop the industrial and economic order that will benefit the younger generation. It has a youth population that is growing so rapidly, one of the biggest in the world, but Pakistan is not making use of it. And that's where this expatriate community should focus on, how to help this young population who need a job, who needs support, who need education. And so this is going to be their challenge. They need to think seriously about the mechanisms for change through their cooperation.
Dr. Paul, something else that fascinates me about this book, you're not Pakistani yourself.
No. But I am of South Asian origin. I'm originally from India. But I don't think you have to be Pakistani to write about Pakistan. My book is 25 years of reading and learning about the region, and I have interacted with a lot of Pakistani officials, ex-officials, through Track 2 meetings, and I have been following it. Mine is kind of a big picture book. It tries to explain a phenomenon, a puzzle, which is why Pakistan has not become strong despite this enormous focus on national security, unlike the European states or the East Asian states, like Korea and Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So mine is a big picture based on historical sociology, and I have the training in many of these fields, international relations, military history, strategic studies, nuclear issues I devote a lot. So it is not meant for show Pakistan in a bad light, but it is to diagnose as a social scientist, and I have no support for either India or Pakistan and what they're doing. I may support a particular positions they're taking, but I would be critical of India too, partly on some of the things it is trying to achieve without proper development in the grassroots level. But looking at Pakistan, it came to realize that nobody has done a comprehensive explanation for this phenomenon. There are very best-selling books right now going on, you know some of them, and they are by journalists, showing that Pakistan is playing double games in Afghanistan, showing that Pakistan is negotiating with the United States without any kind of deep links there. But what is the root cause of all that? And only a good social scientist, and I want to argue that more of these sort of social science work should come forward. I do not mind people criticizing my work or developing alternate arguments, but not because of my ethnic roots or my links. That is an old style of criticizing. I have credentials as a good North American scholar.
And no one would question that, I think. No serious reader of this book. Having said that, I'm thinking of conversations that I've had with Indians who seem very rational, educated, sophisticated even, I would say. And you begin to talk about Pakistan and you can sense the temperature begin to rise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've experienced something.
I have experienced
like
both sides, by the way. It's not just Indians.
So what accounts for that? I mean, given the fact that if you go to India today, you won't find Indian politicians who are calling for the end. Except for on the far right, you won't find calls for the end of the Pakistani state.
No,
that just doesn't.
Even within the far right, it's a very tiny minority.
So is it possible for there to be a Pakistan on a developmental track without the assistance of this enormous neighbor to its south?
Well, it definitely needs this neighbor's market. And that they haven't used at all. Like India
trade.
Is using Chinese market today, despite the rivalry. Hmm. Now, you mentioned why there's so much intense, because this partition business was enormously genocidal, and people are still living in memories, and there hasn't been no Truth or Reconciliation Commission. Nobody has been blamed, nobody has been put to jail, and people who have been killers are also alive in both countries, and I have met a couple of them. They don't want to talk about it. But this enormous tragedy has put so much depth, so much harm into the minds of people. And Indians in general want to forget it, partly because they think it was imposed upon them. They were ready to accept the Muslim minority population, but it was, unfortunately, didn't happen. And so much water has flown, but still the hostility is so permanent. But then there is a problem of Pakistan. From Indian point of view, Pakistan used many opportunities to hurt India. That is 47-48 war, 65 war, 1999 war, the Mumbai attacks, parliament attacks, and the use of non-state tactics. The Pakistani point of view, the Indians haven't been truthful. They haven't given up Kashmir, which they claim, at least according to them, should have gone to them. And the Indians have not been very nice to them on various other occasions. But the problem is the time has changed. Both sides now realize that Kashmir cannot be sold just the way original planners or original ideas were coming out, because the Kashmiris want complete independence and neither wants to give that. So what's the solution? The solution may be to give a more autonomy to this province or region. And that's what Musharraf was trying to push, and they were making some progress. But every time there is a progress, what you notice is spoiler problem. The Mumbai attack is taking place, the parliament attack is taking place, and the Kargil offensive was in response to the India-Pakistan peace negotiations in Lahore, which Prime Minister Vajpayee and at the time, and Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif were handling, and the military under Musharraf didn't like it. So from the Indian point of view, these are the challenges. How do you engage with a neighbor who is not going to follow through these kind of discussions? And the Pakistanis would argue the same thing, that the Indians have occupied the area called Siachen Glacier, etc. Therefore, there is this competition. They need to talk to each other and engage and try to see what common denominator they can agree on. There are a lot of minor disputes they can definitely settle, and they have made progress on that. There's an issue of water sharing. That can be discussed as well. But unfortunately, the opportunities come and then they go. And this is a big challenge for an enduring rivalry like this. You need good leaders who are willing to take that task and come to some kind of agreement.
In the history of Pakistan, so many of its resources have been channeled, directed toward the military. At this juncture, if you want to have a bigger view, bigger perspective, a way to grow Pakistan, you want to forge alliances. It seems that the alliances that are being forged, deals with Iran, for example, largely built around a set of limited resources. I mean, those are defined by what Pakistan has been until now. How do you break that? How do you begin to establish trade relations when your own resources seem to be so limited?
Well, they do have resources. I mean, human resource, number one resource that is not exploited properly. They do have a lot of minerals and natural resources. Now, Chinese companies are starting to exploit them. They're talking about developing ports. China has already got a Gwadar port that is going to be developed, they say. But the problem is, a security problem is so deep that this port and the road towards that port lead through Balochistan. And the Baloch are very unhappy because the Pakistan government does not give them any returns for what they are using that their territory, or taking the gas and natural gas as well as other minerals that this province is plenty of. The challenge is these partners of Pakistan also have a big role to play. You mentioned Iran. I think Saudi Arabia is the more interesting case here. They seem to, the Saudis give money for whatever service they get. Saudis also give money for madrasas and the kind of educational system that is hurting Pakistan. The Saudis should give money to start technical institutions instead of these archaic system of education. The Chinese also give a lot of weapons, nuclear materials. And now increasingly some infrastructure. There's talk of China developing more industries. Why not start something like these special economic zones that China has? China should treat this as their Korea. Instead, China is treating it as an alliance purely, largely for military purposes. The Chinese, I've talked to Chinese, their argument is that our workers get killed if they go there and start building things. So obviously security is their fear, but I think it is also demand. They don't get the demand that they are, they don't get a demand from Pakistan enough for the Chinese to act. And so they need to develop a two-way trade relationship similar to what the U.S. has done with respect to East Asian countries. And the U.S. can also do that. The U.S. has been focusing enormously on giving aid, kind of a transactional relationship without depth to it. That's why there's so much hatred among the Pakistanis, because sometimes the U.S. stops giving aid. And the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, etc., ADB, Asian Development Bank, also give money for tiding over foreign exchange crises.
Just perpetuates the cycle.
Perpetuate the system.
Right, right, right.
Crises are not opportunities for big change. See, without crisis change, in 1991, India went through a major economic crisis, as you may know. It only had $1 billion to pay off the debt for a day. And then they had to collect all the gold bars from the Reserve Bank of India, take overnight to London on an airplane. And this was very humiliating. India was about to go bankrupt. They had never done that. And so that's what propelled the change. Same if you look at Deng Xiaoping's reforms. The reforms are necessary, and the people who take that gutsy decision sometimes are blamed for ills too. But in this country, you don't find that kind of a crisis-induced decision. I'm not saying let them go into a bankrupt situation. But the problem is they need to look at alternate sources of wealth generation, sources of development. They are so focused on this external aid and other little expatriate money. They don't collect much taxes, although tax as a GDP rate is very low. Personal income tax is very low there. There are other taxes they collect. But if only they are able to collect resources internally, extract through industrial growth, through development, to taxation, the state will become a stronger state, as happened in the European context. But the state has to become a more humane state, not based on this coercive approach toward enemies or ethnic groups. It has to be tolerant. Unfortunately, the trend is not that direction.
Dr. T.V. Paul is a professor of international relations at Montreal's McGill University. He is also author of The Warrior State, Pakistan and the Contemporary World. Hope you can join us again here in the Green Room real soon. I'm David Brown of the Texas Standard.